Well, you come to my country for a change, right? We did one live at your place.
No, exactly.
You can come to my country. I can look after you for a while.
Definitely, definitely.
We don't have boudins here, though.
You didn't say it right. Oh, gotcha.
Boudin.
You said it my way.
Well, otherwise, you wouldn't understand me. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 5 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
We talked about conferences a few episodes ago, and right now there are some really great events with open calls for papers. You know, I just applied to iOSCon in London. There's AppDevCon in Amsterdam. Come on, Sean. What's holding you back?
I know. You've been on me about this for a while. I'm happy to tell you, Paul, I am finally submitting my paper to iOSCon in London. Ooh. What was holding me back was I didn't really know what to talk about, right? I've never given a speech, so I'll be a first-time speaker, and I know iOSCon really wants to emphasize that. So, you know, fingers crossed, that helps me out a bit. Hopefully, Paul, you'll be kind enough to look over my submission to, you know, make sure I don't mess it up, and hopefully that helps as well. So, fingers crossed, hopefully I get picked for London to speak, and that'd be awesome. All right, Paul, let's talk about some of the recent news. But first, we're going to talk about an update from last episode, and that is talking about the Swift Evolution Proposal 0230, flattening nested optionals resulting from try? And the good thing is that has been approved and will be implemented in Swift 5. So it's nice to get rid of that optional annoyance, right, Paul?
Yeah, it's such a small change, but it's really nice to see. But remember, it does have the potential to break some code, so watch out.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure there's some people out there in the world that will do a what's new in Swift 5 or here's all the new Swift 5 stuff. Somebody's going to do that, I assume.
Yeah, I reckon so.
We'll remind you then as well. But moving on to the next story, and literally the next story. This is Swift Evolution Proposal 0231, the next proposal on optional iteration. So optional iteration, like what is that? Basically, it's a proposal to create a convenience pattern to handle optionals for iteration, similar to what we have with, you know, itlet, iflet, guardlet, etc. Except now this will be for the keyword for. More on that in a bit. We'll come back to that. But the issue this is trying to solve is that really there's no mechanism to handle the optionality of a sequence directly. So typically as developers, you know, we'll rely on, you know, optional binding before iterating. You know, for example, we'll do iflet sequence equal optional sequence, and then, you know, within that nested iflet statement, you know, we'll do for element in sequence and so on. So basically this causes undesirable nesting, and this proposal suggests a fix for that. The proposal suggests we use for question mark in the for loop. So instead of, you know, for item in array, open close brackets, now it's going to be for question mark item in array. But this is a little different because there's no ability to force unwrap. So, you know, be careful with that.
Yeah, I talked about this on Twitter earlier in the year because the problem is it's annoying to have to handle optional arrays specially. You know, if you have for item in some optional array, you cannot do that. So you either have to have a default value using nil coalescing, or have the iflet and guardlet unwrap, or you have optional chaining with for each, you know, my array question mark dot for each and so forth. And some template languages like Stencil from Gatura or Leaf from Vapor have a really nice empty clause for this exact situation. For thing in array, do some code, empty, do some other code if the array wasn't there. Now, personally, to bike shed this, I prefer for item in question mark, item array, but that's just bike shedding. Either way, it's a really nice improvement for the language, but it's not approved just yet, right?
Yeah, not quite yet. You know, if you look in the schedule, it was supposed to be in review. So this should be, we should find out about this very, very soon. The next topic is a new language server protocol, language service supporting Swift and C family languages for any editor and platform. What does that all mean? So the first two sentences of the announcement actually sum it up very nicely. Like I tried to rewrite it in my own words, but they nailed it perfectly. So we're just going to go with that. It says at Apple, we are making it a priority to support high quality tooling for all Swift developers, including those working on non-Apple platforms. We want to collaborate with the open source community and focus our efforts on building common infrastructure that can be shared by Xcode and other editors and platforms. Paul, why is this a big deal?
I think it's a big deal for one, if not two reasons. Definitely two reasons. Firstly, it shows Apple making a public commitment to supporting developers, regardless of where they're coming from, which is just huge. You know, it's sad, but I think Apple has in some ways grown to be like the Microsoft of the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, early noughties.
How dare you?
They're very focused on their own platforms. You know, it was Windows or nothing, Office or nothing, and so forth. And now it's iOS or nothing. You know, I still haven't got a HomePod, right? Because there's no Spotify support. And I use Spotify, so I can't have a HomePod. Now, MS has changed. They just, in fact, I think today, yesterday, completed their GitHub acquisition. To prove how open source they are these days. And Apple are slowly turning around too, acknowledging they don't control everything. They don't want to control everything. So they might as well try and play nicely with others. A second reason, of course, is it allows other editors like Visual Studio Code or Atom or Sublime Text, whatever you want to use, to hook into the same Swift knowledge Xcode has. Things like syntax highlighting or co-completion, whatever. You know, in theory, it will allow Swift devs to use a huge range of editors, anything they want to, which can only be a good thing, quite frankly. And even better, Xcode itself will be switched over to the new platform. So it's got to be good. They can't screw it up.
Well, speaking of Xcode, so I've only used Xcode for iOS development. So what I struggle with this is, and I know this is probably just my ignorance here, and I can already hear the Twitter responses and comments, but I find it hard to believe that when developing iOS apps, another IDE besides Xcode would be better for iOS development. So that's just hard for me to wrap my head around. Don't get me wrong, I'll admit I've never tried another one. So, you know, but Paul, like, what? How is this better?
Years ago, when I first went to my wife's home country, she's Hungarian, I went to meet her family in Hungary, I met her grandfather, and he was telling me, in Hungarian naturally, how Hungarian was the world's most beautiful language. And of course, he only spoke Hungarian. Right? So yeah. His comparison range is pretty limited. And the same is true in Xcode. If you use one IDE for everything, and you think it's the best thing ever. You know, Visual Studio is an extremely powerful and well-developed IDE. But, you know, topically for this podcast, our open ballot later on, we'll talk about testing. There's an alternative to Xcode called AppCode from the JetBrains people, the same folks who make Kotlin. And it has extraordinary support for testing through test-driven development. It's really, really nice. Probably more on that later, in fact.
Oh, nice. Next up, we have app bundles now supporting Mac apps and free apps with subscription. So that is the news here. That's what's new, is that now Mac apps are supported and free apps with subscriptions. But truthfully, like, I didn't even know app bundles were a thing. So that's also news to me. And I'm sure many out there probably didn't know that as well. So, Paul, how did I miss this? Has this been a thing for a long time? Do you use it?
So I've built Mac apps, I've built subscription-based apps, and I've made app bundles, but the Venn diagram for me is sort of three independent circles. I've never used any of them together. It seems weirdly overdue, I guess, but I'm not sure, honestly, it's going to do much to revive the flagging Mac app store. They need a bit more of a shot in the arm than this, quite frankly.
Yeah, so for those wondering, let's talk about the details of this real quick, because like I said, this app bundles was new to me when I was researching for the show. So you can have 10 apps per bundle, 10 bundles total. You can share some apps between bundles. There's some rules around that we won't get into. There's some territory rules you gotta adhere to as well. If you remove one app from the bundle, the whole bundle, remove one app from sale from the bundle, the whole bundle goes down. You can't mix paid apps with free subscriptions, et cetera, et cetera. More on that, we may have a link in the show notes if you are interested in the app bundles. But like I said, that was all brand new to me. All right, Paul, as always, we do our picks. What do you got for us this time?
So this episode, I want to talk about a blog post from a chap called Jared Sinclair, and it's titled, "Boy, Have I Been Misusing SC Network Reachability," which obviously is one of those clickbaity titles, right? It just sounds so attractive. Who'd not want to click this blog post title?
You'll never guess what happens next.
No, this one husband in Bath found this amazing trick, and doctors will never believe it again. Reachability is a simple system in Apple's system configuration framework which lets us check whether some data somewhere can be received by a remote host. Can I get to google.com? Can I get to apple.com? Whatever it is. And it's quite low level, so most folks use wrappers like reachability.swift. And it's fairly commonly used before making network requests. You know, could the user get this thing or not? You know, it saves having weird error messages down the line by something else showing it. But when it's used badly at the point of the blog post, it's very, very annoying. You know, for me, Netflix is the worst for this. If my Wi-Fi kind of works, I can see Wi-Fi connection on my phone looking at the status bar. It's there. It'll say, sorry, you've turned off cellular download, cellular streaming. You can't have this show. So when you get it wrong, it's very, very annoying. because they think you can't get to the thing when, you know, iOS says you can get to it. So it just frustrates you sometimes.
So it sounds like it's very commonly used wrong, right? If even companies like Netflix are potentially not using it correctly. So like, how are these folks using it wrong?
Well, the problem is many people, and I totally include myself in this, right? We're using it before making a request. Like when the user taps to buy something in a store or check a website, whatever, we might have checked whether the internet was reachable before trying to trigger the purchasing process. You know, just do a quick pre-check, pre-flight check. Can I get google.com? Yes, fine. Now kick off the processing to purchase something, just to avoid weird errors later on. And, you know, Jared's blog post is all about how that's completely wrong. We shouldn't stop a user-initiated request just because reachability says the site can't be reached. That's the wrong way to do it.
Yeah, because, I mean, I read his blog post as well, and wasn't he saying it's not 100% accurate? Like, there's some false positives there, right?
All over the place. Like, you don't expect, you know, if reachability says, yes, if the internet's there or not there, basically, we were trusting it. We were believing it, right? You know,
right, right.
And it's wrong. You know, he's actually made this joke on his site that he's going to update his reachability code to be an enum saying the internet's either probably available, but who knows, as one case, or it worked that one time recently as another case. Because that's how accurate it is. That's really right. Accurate. But we're treating it as like it's the truth. The internet is not available. Don't do the request, or only cellular or whatever. When actually it's much more nebulous, you know. So he recommends still using it, still being useful for things like determining whether to automatically retry a request later on. If something fails, do you want to try in a minute or so again? Or to change the way that we show error messages to users. You know, rather than saying, you know, it didn't work, your failure to buy happened, say something like the internet could be down, because we've done a quick check on it as well. So if we try the request and it came back negative, then do a quick reachability check to see whether the internet in general is available. And if not, fine, go ahead and show a message.
My pick of this episode is going to be Airbnb's animation library, Lottie, as I've been working with that a lot recently at work. So we're going to talk about what that is, how it's useful, and all that good stuff. Paul, have you used Lottie before? Have you heard of it?
Well, my daughter's called Lottie, if that's anything. I have heard of it, and I haven't used it, though. But I do love After Effects, so maybe I should.
I think you should, just from my limited experience with it this week. So it's a two-step process, right? You do all the animations in After Effects. For those that aren't familiar with what After Effects is, that is Adobe's, you know, part of the Photoshop suite, the Creative Cloud suite, and that is how you do a lot of animations. So there's also a plugin called Body Movement that you have to use. So to really, you know, keep this at a high level, you or your designer or your animator or whoever has the animation skills does the animation in After Effects, exports it as JSON, and then literally you just pretty much drop the JSON into your app, and it does this beautiful animations that would have taken hours, days, weeks to actually build in the code. So that is a huge benefit in productivity.
Okay, so your designers in After Effects, they create some gorgeous design, they export to a JSON file, which I guess runs on multiple platforms, I'm not really sure. Now what? You've got a JSON file, what next?
Yeah, so the actual implementation details, we can actually talk through it because it's fairly simple. You basically create a UI view, and you can pin that view to the edge of the screen if you want it full screen or if you just want it in a little window. Whatever UI view size you want, you subclass that UI view as a lot animation view. And then if you're doing it programmatically, you initialize it. The initializer takes in a string name. That is just the name of your JSON file. Or if you're doing it in Storyboard, you have an outlet. There's no initializer there. So you just have to call, we'll call it animation view for now. Dot set animations, and then you pass in a name JSON. So now your animation view is set up with the JSON. And then you literally just call animation view dot play and you're good to go. Your beautiful animation that you created in After Effects will play. There's some other properties you can do like looping, auto reversing, etc. But it's just 95% of the work is done in After Effects. So again, if you're on a team with designers, they're going to do most of the work. They're really just going to hand you a JSON file. You plop it in and you get these beautiful animations.
I think you've definitely sold all the listeners on having someone else do the work.
Well, I say it like that with so much enthusiasm because I do have a designer doing it for me there. So what we're doing at work here is we're building an app for children to manage their asthma. I've mentioned that before. So it's a hardware device that the child has to like blow into, and it's kind of a sophisticated maneuver. So we're using, you know, animations, voiceover, showing them how to do it properly. So like I said, animating that in code would have been a nightmare. Now it's just like, you know, our designer's name is Jared. It's like, hey, Jared, go design that animation. He's like, all right, here's your JSON file. I literally just drop in the JSON file and I'm good to go. So really taking a lot of load off the developers. So Lottie is great. That is just the surface level too, by the way. There are a lot more you can do with it, like changing things at runtime, adding UI elements at runtime. I definitely recommend checking out the repo. Just Google Lottie, L-O-T-T-I-E. You'll find it. The README is amazing. Lots of animation showing you what it can do. So I've been really thrilled with working with Lottie this past week.
Are there any problems with it, or is it basically perfect?
Kind of. And it's not necessarily problems with the actual library. It's just it can't support all of the After Effects features. So like I said, just your designer does most of the work. Well, you can't just send them off into a room by themselves and just say, hey, go wild. There are certain features that it doesn't support, like merge shapes, alpha inverting masks. I mean, I could run down a whole list of designer stuff that most developers probably won't know, but definitely have your designer, and Airbnb does a great job of listing out what's compatible and what's not. So before you pass off your animation to the designer, make sure you give them this list of features they can't use, because when you put it in, when they use some of these features, there's all kinds of compatibility issues and it'll look pretty rough. But as long as they stay away from these certain features, like I said, merge shapes, alpha inverted masks, 3D layer support, etc., there's a huge list, you'll be good to go.
Okay, now it's time for my favorite part of the show, our open ballot. And in this episode, the question is, what's the best way to make sure your code is thoroughly tested? A lot of the answers we got discussed how to make code testable, as well as how to actually do the testing, which is great. Like usual, we'll try and get through as many as we can, starting with our friend Zach from Fireside Swift. He's got a 4-point bullet list of how he makes sure his code's tested thoroughly. Number one is have someone else that you trust write your tests. Number two, write tests yourself. Number three, have someone else QA your code. And number four, terrifyingly, users test it in production. It all get tested eventually. And Scott Robbins says, having clear requirements on what piece of code in a project need unit tests and code review to validate they're there and test what they're supposed to. And this is interesting, actually, because I think, well, firstly, having clear requirements is great because it's actually quite rare to have in software development to have clear requirements. But secondly, it makes you think of an old saying, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, which bit of your app do you want to write tests for? Only the bits you don't want to crash.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to the answers we got back this week from everybody, because like I mentioned last week, testing is one of the biggest holes in my game. I need to improve it. So super excited to see what everyone had to say, because like Zach said, I was kind of in that boat of have someone else QA your code, you know, ship it, users test in production as a joke. You know, I loved his line. It all gets tested eventually. That cracked me up. Now, I don't do that. Most of my career has basically been spent, you know, zero to launch, and you're just rushing to the launch date. So unfortunately, testing falls by the wayside. So that's kind of my story and how I got to where I'm at. So let's move on. I can't wait to hear some of these other answers.
So we had some good answers on how to split your code into layers, which is really about making it more testable. So Suhit Patil said he wants to divide his code into separate layers, then use dependency injection with interfaces instead of concrete objects to talk to the different layers to make it easier to do mocking. Plus red-green refactor will cover later on. And Roberto Raquelme said, I always try to follow a testing pyramid, considering things that can't be automated to most coverage possible in unit tests. So starting unit tests first, then integration tests, then UI tests, and finally manual tests, which he says are more expensive and slower, whatever suits your need.
Yeah, this pyramid I found very, very helpful because, I knew intuitively that, you know, certain things like manual testing took longer and was very tedious and painstaking. But seeing this visual of the pyramid, and I don't know, maybe we'll include the link in the show notes, but because you guys can't see what we're looking at. But yeah, that was very, very helpful. And I like what Suhit said about dividing your code into separate layers. We'll get into it a little bit later, but it seems MVVM is a very testable design pattern. So need to start looking into that as well.
That is the main benefit of MVVM, quite frankly, is making your code more testable. You know, any class that imports UIKit is immediately less testable. Now, the thing with testing is that unit tests, you know, they test business logic alone, they get very hard to do because of the way we throw things into the view controllers. You know, you have this big, mammoth, massive view controller occupying all your functionality. It's very hard to test that kind of code. And so it's increasingly common to see people doing snapshot tests, you know, UI tests, where they'll either do Xcode XE UI test, or they'll do Uber/Facebook snapshot library, which is important and very cool, and I like it very much, but it's not your first point of call, right? You want to start at unit tests first, nail those thoroughly, and then add UI tests on top, because having UI tests as your only port of call is just a really shaky foundation to be on. We had some answers about continuous integration, CI. Damien Lofton said, make sure your continuous integration build fails if a test fails. Christaps Grinberg said, firstly, you've got to write more test code than actual code. Secondly, it should be up to date and trusted. And thirdly, run every change in CI. And Mike Kane chimes in with very similar stuff, saying when testing setup in CI, have it go through those checks automatically. And once that passes, and have it merge into master, where your automated test continues to try and break that code. So there's lots about here of CI, getting in there as fast as possible. And this is actually really, really helpful and actually fairly fundamental, I think, nowadays. People, you know, you look at some of the amazing functionality people have with GitHub hooks, doing commits and PRs and so forth. You know, Circle CI, you could hooks right into your GitHub flow. So you can say, listen, this code cannot be merged into master, at least it's been through at least one other code review has approved it, and Circle CI has passed all its tests, get a green light coming back. And of course, there are other alternatives out there, but I personally use Circle. It's automatic. Why wouldn't you do this? You know, it's so simple to do. And it takes away that fear of, did it break something by surprise?
Yeah, it seems like continuous integration is a must. Again, I don't have a ton of experience with it because I've pretty much been the only developer on all my projects, maybe a two-man team, but never a large team to where this was, you know, vital. Definitely got to look into that too. One thing I want to touch on Christaps's comment is, firstly, we need to write more test code than actual code. Really? Is that true? Let's talk about that for a second, Paul. Again, like I said, limited experience in testing, but I know typically 100% code coverage doesn't happen. Maybe you get, you know, X percent, but is there really more test code than actual code?
No. I can see why it's a good thing to aim for. Sometimes testing can get into sort of procrastination, where you are wasting time in a way it feels productive. And usually you'll find this with people who say they want 100% code coverage for their tests. Mm-hmm. And that's very hard to do. Getting 100% is difficult to do. You know, you've got to put in some really quirky corner case edge stuff to make 100%. What are you trying to prove? I've seen companies that have thousands and thousands. I saw one, you know, last month that had 7,500 tests, and it took them 25 minutes to run their test code, and they know there's too many. They haven't got time to refactor them all, and it starts getting to the point where, you know, if your CI fails because a test didn't pass, is that test actually important? Can it go away? Does it need to be there? You haven't got time anymore. You just add more and more workarounds and more tests. You know, tests start to fight against you. And that's the last place you want to be. And so there's a bit of a disaster area, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great clarification. Like I said, as somebody that's trying to wrap their head around the best way to come at all this testing stuff, I see stuff like that all the time, or, you know, aim for 100%. And like you said, you kind of nailed what I was thinking, to be honest with you. I was like, is that really worth it? Like, there's got to be diminishing returns at some point. And it sounds like that's what you were talking about. So thanks for the clarification.
Just remember, 100% coverage just means every line of code's been run when tests were happening. Doesn't mean your tests in any way show your code is working correctly. Just means every line of code was run. That's all it means. You know, it's a bit simple, really. Then, as you said, we have a few on MVVM. We had Simon saying, assuming I'm using MVVM, I would care most about view model code, making sure the view models are a separate module. Then test that module with coverage reports on CI for each merge request with minimum coverage set up, and don't allow merge before that coverage requirement's hit. Then Chris Winstanley said, we usually test our view models and our coordinators and services to a good level, over 80% coverage. Make them easy to test with good input and output, because we find UI tests too flaky and sometimes require more maintenance than the code under test.
Yeah, it sounds like we covered this a bit earlier with the MVVM model when we discussed that, like you said, as soon as you import UIKit, it immediately becomes less testable. So again, as I'm looking at this almost as a part of the audience, to be honest with you. This is an interesting experience doing this open ballot, because we're reading these and going over them, I'm like, okay, what am I going to implement? What advice am I going to take? What am I not going to take? So MVVM is one that's really, really standing out to me. So yeah, I'm curious to hear more about the MVVM aspect of this.
So Simon's point is, you know, MVVM is a starting point for him, but actually there's a bigger thing here, which is moving the model code to a separate module. Because that way, it becomes extremely obvious when you start to have sort of leakage, you know, leaky abstractions between your layers and your code. It's a different module. It's obviously leaking between stuff. So the model areas and its own module, its own rules doing coverage and CI and so forth, which is a really smart idea. Chris's point, now Chris works for a very big company, works for the BBC in the UK, so they must take testing very, very seriously. And I'd agree that 85%-ish coverage is a smart target to aim for. Now, he does also say, which I think it's a number of important things, having good input and output. This goes back to making code testable as well as tested. You know, it's much easier to write good tests when your code is more testable. And one of the ways to do that is with good input and good output, i.e. things like stateless / pure functions with functional programming. Don't modify data, don't rely on external state. Just hand in good input and get same output, which makes your tests way easier to do. And as for UI tests, of course, the XE UI test has a little record button in Xcode that basically generates gibberish. It generates horrifying code that it'll do, it won't compile. It's that bad. And there's UI tests like snapshot testing from Uber and Facebook. And I've seen people have, again, to over 2,000 snapshot tests. And when one fails, I mean, a snapshot test, this literally looks at a screenshot of how it was and how it is currently and compares it to pixel by pixel. And if they're different, boom, it's wrong. So when you go from Xcode 9.3 to 9.3.1 or 10.0 to 10.1 and the iOS simulator changes by a tiny fraction, your tests are likely to fail. Do you trust them or not? I don't know. What will happen is people say, oh, it's a snapshot test. Don't worry, hit re-record, take a new snapshot, it'll be fine. But then you've got into this mentality of, I don't trust my tests anymore. And as soon as a test is not reliably a good indicator of bad code, it's pointless. It works against you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Swift Over Coffee. Before we go, we want to propose the question for the open ballot next episode, and that is, should UIs surprise and delight users, or is it better to be functional?
Well, you know, I just discovered this amazing new framework called Lottie.
There you go. You're going to surprise and delight the hell out of people there. So tell your friends to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter @SwiftOverCoffee. We'll see you in the next one.
Bye.